very warm. It's a lot of wind up there. And right now, it's really the driest part of the entire state of Alaska.
Wildfires burn thousands of acres in western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 12th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission pushes for new protections for the bowhead quota.
The legislation sets an example for the rest of the world by requiring the U.S. government to set limits if the IWC fails to do so.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Premera.com. Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Wildfires are burning in western Alaska. The past 2 months have seen warm, dry weather in much of that part of the state, and with several thunderstorms last week, conditions have been ripe for wildfires. Doug Gibbs is the Alaska Fire Service's assistant fire manager for the Galena Zone, an area that spans most of western Alaska above the Yukon River, including the Seward Peninsula, all the way up to Barrow.
We are really the only spot in the state that has been busy. We've had some fires right around Galena in the lower Yukon, but up on the Kobuk is where the majority of these fires happened. We used all the smoke jumpers we had, and then we ordered more smoke jumpers from the lower 48 and ended up putting them on the fires on the Kobuk as well.
Gibbs says the Kobuk area is under high fire danger warnings.
Because it's very warm, it's very dry, there's a lot of wind up there, so we're paying particular attention to that part of the state, and right now it's really the driest part of the entire state of Alaska.
Gibbs says in just 2 days last week, more than 20 fires started in the Galena Zone. While a handful were in unpopulated areas where the fires were only monitored, the majority of last week's fires were what Gibbs calls action fires, calling the BLM to send firefighters.
That would be fires that we send firefighters out on and actively try and put out, because those fires are either close to native allotments or people's cabins, and for whatever reason, the land manager, whether it's the Park Service or the BLM or the Fish and Wildlife Service, has deemed that we put fires out in that area.
The fire service has staged crew and equipment at Doll Creek near Kobuk as the fire season progresses. So far this year, a total of 176 fires have burned about 26,000 acres statewide. Fires in the Galena Zone represent almost half of the total acreage lost to fire this year in the state. The International Whaling Commission is meeting next month in Panama City to set whaling catch limits around the world. The commission is supposed to set a quota for Alaska's subsistence whalers for the next 5 years, but the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is concerned their subsistence quota will fail to pass in the heated climate surrounding international whaling. So the AEWC is pushing for legislation that would allow the U.S. to set the subsistence catch limit in Alaska. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reports.
Under the international treaty that regulates whaling, the International Whaling Commission is supposed to set a subsistence catch limit for bowheads in Alaska, but that hasn't always happened at IWC meetings. Earl Comstock is an attorney with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and helped draft legislation that would allow the U.S. to set a catch limit when Alaska gets pushed off the IWC agenda.
What this legislation says is, okay, if the IWC no longer feels the need to set the catch limit or because of its own political difficulties doesn't get around to setting the catch limit that's requested, we will, through the Secretary of Commerce, have a catch limit set. It is completely consistent with the treaty and is what the treaty allows.
The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is worried for good reason. Comstock says in 2002, the IWC failed to set a quota for subsistence whaling in Alaska because of international pressure.
This is part of the political dynamic of the IWC. The Japanese were interested in having the commission approve a different type of whaling that's not currently allowed under the treaty. And in an effort to focus international attention on their request, they took the opportunity to block the U.S. quota.
And then in 2007, the IWC meeting ended abruptly after a contentious debate on sanctions in South America that would establish protected areas where whaling would be prohibited. The IWC did set the Alaska catch limit, but it wasn't a priority at that meeting. Johnny Aiken is executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. He's concerned because the same controversial issue is the first item on this year's agenda.
And that's what we're really worried about, is if they're not able to get through this Southern Hemisphere sanctuary proposal, we may not get our quota.
Senator Mark Baggage is introducing the legislation. In an email, his spokesperson, Julie Haskett, says the legislation is necessary because the IWC is a dysfunctional group with no chairman or definition of a quorum for this year's event. Johnny Aiken helped draft the language of the bill.
The legislation sets an example for the rest of the world by requiring the U.S. government to set limits if the IWC fails to do so. And we have pursued this because we don't feel comfortable of how the International Whaling Commission meetings will go.
Aiken stresses that whaling for Alaska Natives is an important way of life and a source of food. And he says Alaska Natives are highly knowledgeable about the bowhead whale population and use sustainable hunting methods.
We know that we hunt the bowhead whale well below its recruitment rate.
Whale census numbers show the bowhead population growing at 3% per year. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is sending about 15 people to the IWC conference at the beginning of July. In Anchorage, I'm Wendy Johnson.
A soldier assigned to Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Anchorage has been killed in Afghanistan. The Army is reporting Private First Class Nathan Tyler Davis died June 9th when his vehicle was attacked with an improvised explosive device. Davis was driving the vehicle. The 20-year-old was from California and joined the Army in 2010. This was his first deployment. Davis was a member of the 4th Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division, the 3500 Soldier Brigade deployed in December. Three other soldiers were wounded in the incident. Next of kin have been notified. Traffic is moving again on a section of the Alaska Highway in the Yukon Territory that was closed for 4 days because of a washout. Alan Nixon, Assistant Deputy Minister of Highways and Public Works, says many people driving recreational vehicles and campers waited until this morning to get back on the road. The washout occurred along a critical stretch of the Alaska Highway north of Watson Lake. Crews worked around the clock to repair the highway, which was reopened last night. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, saying goodbye to Celebration 2012 in Juneau with a dance procession.
It was arduous and tiresome, and it was better than aerobics.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A federal mine safety official from Anchorage has been at the Pogo gold mine since this morning, investigating the evacuation and shutdown of the mine in response to a vehicle fire underground early this morning. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports from Delta Junction.
Pogo spokeswoman Lorna Shaw says an official with the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration arrived at the mine this morning and has been checking out the site and examining the company's plan to get the mine back in operation.
They're reviewing the entry plan. We're hopeful that we'll be able to go back into the mine here shortly.
Pogo officials had hoped to resume operations later today, but a federally mandated reopening process makes that less likely. Mine officials evacuated 34 workers just after midnight when the operator of a haul truck reported a fire in the engine compartment. The operator activated the rig's onboard fire suppression system, which extinguished the fire. Then he contacted the mine supervisor, who ordered the evacuation and shutdown. Shaw says the evacuation was a routine action taken in compliance with federal regulations and company policy. The mine is located about 38 miles northeast of Delta and is owned and operated by Japan-based Sumitomo Metal Mining. Shaw says the evacuation was conducted safely and that no injuries occurred. She says Pogo officials determined soon afterward that there was no smoke nor carbon monoxide in the mine.
The biggest thing in all of this is that nobody was hurt, and that's the most important.
Mine Safety and Health Administration spokespersons in Anchorage and Washington, D.C. were unavailable to talk about the Pogo mine incident. Shaw said in a news release issued today that the mine will remain closed until federal mine safety officials review it and approve the company's reentry plan. She says a routine process of reopening the mine involving a team of mine rescue personnel must be conducted before the mine can be reopened. Shaw says both Sumitomo and the Federal Mine Safety Agency will conduct investigations.
Certainly, we're launching an internal investigation into the incident, and you know, once we know what has happened exactly, we'll be reviewing that with all of our employees.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Sydney, Australia-based Riversdale, Alaska, has been awarded a state coal lease in the Chicoloon area. Riversdale was the high bidder for the almost 10,000 acres of potential coal-bearing lands in the Matanuska-Susitna borough, paying a more than $3 million bonus for the lease. The land is owned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and leased by the authority's Lands Trust Office. Greg Jones is the Lands Trust Office Executive Director.
We've signed an agreement with Riversdale that gives them the right to explore, and if they are able to find a resource, find the coal, and get permits, it allows them to mine those lands subject to all applicable state, federal, and local permits. We are at this point along for the ride in hopes that they're successful.
Riversdale has focused on the Chicoloon leases because the company considers Chicoloon area coal to be high quality and low sulfur, according to Riversdale's own publications. The Chicoloon project is desirable, too, because of the proximity of a deep water port and rail access to that port. Jones says it is now up to Riversdale to determine if conditions are right for a mine.
We will be monitoring it closely. We'll be assuring that they meet the conditions of our lease, which requires them to meet all state and federal regulations. The ball is in Riversdale's court to meet all of those criteria to determine if they can develop a mine.
Riversdale, Alaska manager Russell Dan was not available for comment today, but Michelle Johnson, who is handling public information for the project, says intent to explore permits have been granted, and the company is planning aggressive baseline studies on the area for the next 2 years. Improvements on roads to the coal leases could be the first step, she says. The State Department of Natural Resources is in the process of weighing an exploration permit for Riversdale, according to coal Regulatory Program Manager Russell Kirkham. Public comments on the permits are being taken through June 18th. Some area organizations, such as the Mat Valley Coalition and Friends of Matsu, are opposed to coal mining based on health concerns related to coal dust and because of environmental degradation resulting from mining. Greg Jones with the Mental Health Trust Lands Office says the agreement with Riversdale was signed in March. Although the deal has not been made public yet, Jones says the Mental Health Trust will not see much financial benefit from the lease agreement unless a successful mine is developed. In that case, the trust gains a 5% royalty on the resources extracted. A week-long salmon fishing closure went into effect Sunday for subsistence fishers on the Kuskokwim River. It's the second year in a row that subsistence fishing during the King Salmon Run has been restricted on the river. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Throughout June, the entire Kuskokwim River will be closed to salmon fishing, one section at a time. It's called a rolling closure and splits the river into five sections, which are closed 7 days at a time following the King Salmon Run as it progresses upriver. The decision to begin the rolling closure was made at a three-hour meeting of the Kuskokwim Salmon Management Working Group, a group that includes industry reps and subsistence fishers up and down the Kuskokwim. At the meeting, the group talked about the current low numbers, The state's monitoring program, the Bethel Test Fishery, is seeing the third lowest numbers in its history since it began in 1984. Nonetheless, the decision did not come easy.
I just have this feeling of darn if we do, darn if we don't.
That's working group member Mike Williams Sr. of ACYAC, who, along with several others, were concerned that the closures would cause combat fishing when people rush out to get all their fish at once. Generally, drying fish for the winter is easier at the start of the season, before the wet weather sets in. Williams said traditional subsistence fishing is conservation, following the strength of the salmon run and the weather.
In this Kuskokwim River, the people have made sure that there's enough fish on the river for escape mode and take what we need.
The length of the closure was also discussed, with several people speaking out against it, including James Charles, an elder from the coastal village of Tututuliak.
These people don't like to see the river being closed, but if we have to close the river for subsistence, they would like to see it shorter than 7 days.
Travis Ellison, acting area management biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says 7 days is the minimum that's needed to get fish all the way upriver.
The reality is that a fish that enters on the 6th or 7th or even the 5th day of the first closure downstream is not going to make it out of that section before it reopens, and then it'll be vulnerable to harvest.
The working group also talked about other factors, including colder than normal weather, high water, and the fact that the run is probably late. However, managers believe despite all these factors, the numbers are still low. In the end, the vote was unanimous to start rolling closures. The Bethel region, which is the river's most populated area, will begin its closure at midnight. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
A former Alaskan is one of five finalists for the 2012 Outside Magazine Outdoor Adventure Grant. Quinn Langbauer is a 2007 Sitka High graduate. If he wins, he and his brother and a friend from college will spend most of next year bicycling over 7,000 miles across Siberia. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
So what do Mike and Quinn actually want to do? The plan is to retrace Mark's two-wheeled expedition through Siberia, contrast their experiences with Mark's 23 years before. They're guessing things have probably changed.
To enter the $10,000 contest, you have to submit a short video to Outside Magazine. Langbauer works as a chemical engineer in Midland, Texas, but it's clear by watching his two-minute movie that he may have missed his true calling.
Mark Jenkins literally wrote the book on adventure. While Mike and Quinn haven't written any books yet, they do have over 44 years of combined life experience. 45 and a half if you include time in the womb.
Langbauer and his former roommate from the University of Wyoming, Mike Richard, drew inspiration for their idea from Mark Jenkins, the author of The Hard Way, who lectured at their school. Jenkins rode a bike in 1989 east to west from Vladivostok to Leningrad, just as the Soviet Union was transitioning to democracy. Examining social change over the past 23 years is a chance to make this trip appear less selfish, Langbauer says. But there's also an underlying philosophy that runs deep for someone who's been out of college for just over a year.
I think for both of us, this is a pretty good excuse.
Langbauer brought out this idea in a 500-word essay that accompanied his entry. The ideas here are as serious as his movie is fun.
And you get opportunities, and passing them up is always easy. I mean, you can always say, oh, I got school next semester, I've got work on Monday, but you do that enough and it becomes habitual. And so I really just talked about how for us we needed to, we understood this was a pretty amazing opportunity, and if we were lucky enough, this was definitely a good point in our lives for us to go ahead and not pass something like that up and go ahead and take it, I guess.
The trip, as planned, is about 7,500 miles. Langbauer and Richard and Langbauer's younger brother, Seth, will be on the road, mostly camping, for between 6 and 8 months, starting in the spring of next year. They haven't decided on equipment yet, but they're looking into a kind of bike called a 29er, a mountain bike with larger diameter wheels. 6 to 8 months is a long time to share a tent, a camp, even a desolate Siberian road. Langbauer says he and Richard have been through a lot together and should get through this.
You know, we've done some trips that are, you know, a couple days, but where you don't sleep the whole time. And you know, when you're on edge and you're tired, it's always easier to bicker and that kind of thing. Me and Mike just never really ever seem to have that problem. You know, a handful of people I can see myself doing it with. Mike's pretty high up on that list.
Langbauer says he's not concerned about physically training for the ride. It's the mental stamina that worries him. Ideally, there will be enough human interaction in retracing the journey to relieve some of the strain. Mark Jenkins did his famous ride with four Russians and a Soviet escort part of the way. Neither Langbauer, his brother Seth, or Richard speak Russian or any of the languages they may encounter along the way. Langbauer is well-traveled, however. He believes we have a common form of expression that will serve the riders well.
It's always difficult initially, and then you always remember I'm talking to just another person, even though we don't speak the same language. I mean, you can't communicate with words, but I find people are always so helpful and so eager to help.
Langbauer says he was surprised when he got the call from Outside Magazine that his Siberian bike ride had been selected as one of 5 finalists for this year's Outdoor Adventure Grant. The winner will be decided by the number of likes each candidate receives on Facebook. Langbauer says many of his coworkers in Texas have been supportive and have been liking his entry every day, but he hasn't really gotten around to asking management for time off yet. It would be premature anyway.
I've kind of left some of the bosses out of the loop maybe a little more.
You can find Langbauer's entry by going to Facebook and searching for Outside Magazine. Voting will end on June 17th. As of this writing, biking across Siberia was in second place.
Can't tell you they deserve it more than anyone else, but they can tell you.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
We'd love to go on an adventure.
Celebration 2012 ended Saturday night with the grand exit, where groups from as far away as Anchorage and the Pacific Northwest made their final procession. At the lead and at the start of the Southeast Native Cultural Festival's grand entrance was one dance group from Angoon. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld spoke to the group's leaders and filed this report.
Gilbert Fred and Alan Zuboff lead the Huichedaquan dancers as they drum more than 1,000 people across Celebration 2012's main stage. It's a sea of blue, red, and black button blankets, turquoise and yellow-faced Chilkat weavings, intricately beaded vests, and carved animal form clan hats. Fred and his brother-in-law Zuboff move back and forth across the stage, directing traffic as they sing and dance. From time to time, one moves towards the entrance, urging an arriving dance group to sync drum beats with those on stage. Fred says it was a great honor.
It was arduous and tiresome, and it tested our fortitude, and it was better than aerobics. But I think it was indeed a labor of love for our culture and for the fact that you had so many different nations coming together here converging on Junu to share our culture with one another.
The grand entrance continues for more than 2 hours until everyone is in the hall. Zuboff says the group's strength comes from its experience dating back several generations.
When it first began, it was just an elders group. But as time went on, the elders realized that the young ones weren't learning. So they did something that they have never done in a lot of generations. They decided that the young ones, including the babies, should start dancing in order for them to learn.
Today's group continues sharing those traditions. Members work with the Hootsnuwu Dutch Kankean dancers formed through the Angoon School's Indian Education Program. Like many traditional adult groups, the Huitzidaquan dancers wear expertly crafted regalia adorned with images of their history and culture. Zuboff wears a clan hat more than 300 years old, and he's worn blankets handed down over three or four generations.
It's not just a common piece of thread or a piece of wood. It's a bit of all the spirits of the older generation that made this and danced in them. Mm-hmm. And you can sometimes you can maybe feel their energy mm-hmm. in the dance group, or you can sometimes you can hear them singing. To hear them saying, do this.
Every celebration has a different lead dance group, chosen by a committee of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, which organizes the events. Institute President Rosita Wuerl says members picked this group because of its strength and its sense of tradition. Leaders Zuboff and Fred are thankful for the recognition, but they're also glad they don't have to direct such a massive group of dancers for a while.
It's almost like you feel your canoe trying to get sucked into a tidal current, right, Alan?
Yeah.
And we're able to restabilize and readjust.
The Angoon group led the event starting grand entrance, following a Native veteran's color guard. It also headed up the grand exit, ending the three-day event. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Tim Ellis in Delta, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Wendy Jonathan reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.